Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson is a multifaceted guitar shop offering guitar instruction, new and used guitars and amplifiers, and all accessories. We offer guitar repair of the highest quality. Instead of experiencing the total hassle of a big box store, take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson and experience what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We love guitars.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast brought to you by the United Steelworkers at Sly'sOffice.com. Joining us now from the Capital Times and the Nation, John Nichols. So I kept hearing this last name, Gorsuch, right? It's sticking in my mind for some reason. And I didn't know anything about Neil Gorsuch, the federal judge from Colorado. Didn't know a thing about him. Hadn't heard of him. But for some reason, that name kept sticking in my mind, John Nichols. Do you remember that name?
I do. Although I always think of, is it an Ann?
Yes. For way back to the Reagan administration, she was very naughty.
There was a little trouble there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
No this relation,
is,
I'm sure.
This is her son.
I know, I'm teasing. It's Ann Gorsuch, was it Burford?
Right, Ann Burford Gorsuch, yeah.
No, Burford Gorsuch.
Yeah, it? Right.
I'm really searching the back of my head.
I know. Well, it was just, remember those things used to pass as scandals back then. This is pre-Trump, right? So Ann Burford Gorsuch ran the Environmental Protection Agency. At the outset of the Reagan administration, she was forced to resign in 1983, facing a criminal investigation in House contempt of Congress citation over records related to alleged political favoritism in toxic waste cleanups.
Right. It was the Superfund stuff, right?
Yeah.
She wouldn't cooperate. Yeah.
Right. So anyway, that is who our next Supreme Court Justice's mother is.
Oh, well, more power to her. Yeah. I'm sure she's...
Well, for all we know, she's dead. I have no idea.
I don't know the answer, but I'm, you know, I do remember that controversy. You know, it was a nasty one in its day, and you were saying those were passes for scandal in those days, but it was a pretty serious issue because the refusal to cooperate with Congress is a big deal, and it was around fundamental environmental issues. Remember, Reagan was not really so great on environmental issues.
No,
as you recall, there were some. Remember, was it James Watt?
Oh yeah,
yeah. All the good players of the past.
Yeah, James Watt had been around a while. James Watt, of course, had been in the Nixon administration and Ford administration as well. All right, so it appears later today, Donald Trump will name Neil Gorsuch to be his next Supreme Court justice. I don't know whether it's for.
Yeah, we're hearing a couple of names. Yeah,
I think we're hearing everything that I've read before we went to airtime this afternoon was that this is going to be the guy. So,
yeah, well, then Trump, minds can change.
I understand, and what he's flying in more than one candidate, right?
He's
turning this into kind of the Apprentice.
Man. Yeah, it's like a mystery man, international man of mystery. It's like Austin Powers kind of thing. You don't really know. Until you know.
Well, I think Gorsuch has been the front runner for this.
There's a guy from up in Pittsburgh that they've been talking about as well. But you're right, Gorsuch, and I hope we're pronouncing it right.
Yep.
Gorsuch, I think it is.
I know how to pronounce it because I remembered his mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the National Review folks are saying Trump will nominate Judge Neil Gorsuch. Whose philosophy resembles that of Justice Scalia.
Well, that's an interesting piece in Politico about him in that he is maybe not a complete duplicate figure of Scalia, but that he is Barack Obama's contemporary in law school. They went to law school together.
Yeah, they're a little young, a year or so younger.
Yeah, right. But so he went to Oxford, he went to Harvard. He went to Columbia, so he's obviously got the typical credentials of a Supreme Court justice, but that he writes very well and that they're hoping he'll be persuasive with Anthony Kennedy.
Right. And he has, if I'm not mistaken, if he is the nominee, he has a quite striking background of who he worked with as a clerk, and the different steps he's taken up the ladder with some really, really very important people, including, by the way, Kennedy.
So, you know, a lot of this is speculative. They're talking about how he may be different from Scalia in one way, that he's less willing to defer to regulations, and might be more willing to second-guess Trump. You really can't tell these things until somebody gets on the court.
Well, I will tell you, he did his little stint with some corporate law.
Oh, stuff, so, this is not going to be somebody that you and I like.
Yeah, I may be wrong, but I'm not entirely betting that he's going to, turn out as some sort of, radical force there on the court. Although I will point out, I think he's the first nominee for a Supreme Court justice position who was with the Columbia University marching band.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
That's tragic. That's
good, isn't it? Yeah. We don't know.
76 trombones and the big parade.
Maybe they'll come to the swearing in if that happens and stuff.
Oh, my God. Though George W. Bush was a cheerleader. So
believe the term you're looking for. Well, Trent Lott was quite a cheerleader. And that's cool because that's pretty athletic. I think so, I'm not kidding. I will promise you that I'm sure that when Trent Lott was a cheerleader, he was in better shape than you or I will ever be.
I'm sure he was. All right, what do you make of this Sally Yates firing?
Well, I think that's a bad thing. I think it was a really, what I love is, sort of the apologists for presidential power, the people who have gotten, kind of so lost in the concept of the imperial presidency that they forget that the attorney general is, supposed to be a law enforcement officer, right? And as such, it is not the attorney general's job to send out Justice Department lawyers to defend or advance legal strategies developed for political reasons that are legally or constitutionally dubious, okay? You're not supposed to do that. And, of course, we've had plenty of attorney generals who've stumbled and failed in this regard. But, what she did after, I hope I'm correct on this, I think it's 4 federal judges have ruled on elements of Donald Trump's executive order. And they have said, look, you got problems here. This is not right. You have to stay elements of it, where even the Trump people have struggled to get clarity on what it does and what it doesn't do. Is it a Muslim ban? Does it have to do with religion?
We'll get to that in a moment.
But as Sean Spicer said today, it's not about religion. It's about travelers.
All right.
So, but all I'm saying is, let me finish this just core concept though. All of these things in play and all this push and pull on this thing, but at some fundamental level, she made the determination that this wasn't a good use of time or energy or, frankly, the basic premises of the Department of Justice to go into court and defend this thing. That's a acting attorney general can do that and say to the president of the United States, you really ought to take a look at this thing. Now, she isn't the only one. We have Republican U.S. senators saying that. We have Republican members of the House of Representatives saying that. We have newspaper editorial boards. We have legal scholars. We have judges saying it. And so she said this, and then Donald Trump said, well, that's it. Cause for removal. You're up.
He said that she had betrayed the Department of Justice.
And that's just, we should not let this stand. What he's done is done, but we shouldn't let this just, this concept just be in play, because if this is Donald Trump's vision of the Department of Justice, that it's betraying. It's a betrayal of the mission of that department if it doesn't do exactly what he wants it to do, right? Then we've got a big problem here. There's a term for that, actually. It's a constitutional crisis.
All right, so...
And you say, well,
all right, so many moons ago, when she had her hearing to get her job in the Department of Justice, she was questioned by Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. So now, pardon the Washington Post dubbing some music because they have text typed into this as well, but read between the lines here. Again, pardon the music. Here we go.
I like the music. It's good.
You have to watch out because people will be asking you to do things you just need to say no about. Do you think the Attorney General has a responsibility to say no to the president if he asks for something that's improper? A lot of people have defended the Lynch nomination, for example, by saying, well, he appoints somebody who's going to execute his views. What's wrong with that? But if the views the president wants to execute are unlawful, should the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General say no?
Senator, I believe that the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution and to give their independent legal advice to the president.
Like any CEO with a law firm, sometimes the lawyers have to tell the CEO, Mr. CEO, you can't do that. Don't do that. We'll get a suit. It's going to be in violation of the law. You'll regret it. Please, no matter how headstrong they might be. Do you feel like that's the duty of the Attorney General's office?
I do believe that that's the duty of the Attorney General's office.
So there you go.
Yeah. So she followed her duty as sworn to Jeff Sessions.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, this is the point. And I liked what Sessions did there. You know, he had a, you know, be in his bonnet about Barack Obama. And, you know, wanted to make sure that a top official in the Department of Justice, a senior official, would be willing to say no, right? I think that's appropriate. And it happened, though, that when the president changed, you got another president, and she was, in fact, willing to say no. In fact, that she has a record of being of standing on principle on a host of issues. But, you know, when she did this with a president who happens to have appointed Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III to the AG's position, or at least nominated him for that position. When she said no, that was somehow unacceptable. And that's just wrong, Sly. And when we use this term constitutional crisis, I think that some people get all freaked out and they're like, oh my gosh, that means that, you know, it's like in one of those movies where, you know, we have kind of decay of the whole thing, crisis moment, an emergency. No, a constitutional crisis can be slow-moving. The ACLU refers to Donald Trump as a one-man constitutional crisis. Like, wherever he is, there's a crisis. But it can be slow-moving. It can be bureaucratic. It can take many, many different forms. But when you have a clear circumstance where somebody is, with a great deal of authority, is disregarding, disrespecting, perhaps even misunderstanding the Constitution with its system of checks and balances, of separated powers, and with clearly defined duties for different public servants, as well as a rule of law and constitutional authority. You know, when these things come into conflict, that is a crisis. It may not be explosive in the moment, and you know, you may say, well, you know, she's going to be, you know, she's been replaced, somebody else stepped up, he found his Robert Bork there, and you know, put this person in to do, you know, what he wanted done, and that person will be gone soon, and then Sessions will be there probably, and you know, you say, so you know, what's a few days? Well, that's exactly the issue. What is a few days? Why did Donald Trump have to remove her? Why didn't he simply, you know, accept this situation and say, you know, look, this is why I want Jeff Sessions approved quickly by the Senate. I don't approve of what she's done here. I'm uncomfortable with this. You know, why didn't he call her over the White House? Talk to her about it. Why didn't they sit down and craft a better executive order?
Let me ask you this question. Why did he say that she was weak on borders and weak on illegal immigration?
It's a political statement. That's where people get scared and people get concerned, because this is President of the United States saying to someone, put it this way, maybe it's the best way to explain it. This is a president of the United States saying to someone who has the ability to ruin you, Sly, to put you in jail, to investigate you, to prosecute you, to do profound things to you. President of the United States saying to that person, I want you, acting Attorney General of the United States, to take these steps for political reasons or because of, you know, I have this political view, and I want you to do these things. Well, when you say that to somebody who has the ability to put people in jail, to prosecute them, to investigate them, to potentially ruin folks, right? That starts to blur the lines.
See, but that's the whole MO of this man. He can never disagree with somebody on policy. Everything is scorched earth, and he personalizes his attacks with everyone that he has a disagreement with. Right? Yeah.
No, this is profound stuff. And this is why, John, I wrote about this today for a piece for the Nation. John Dean's in it. And John Dean, I quote him, says that, you know, when you look at what, paraphrasing a little bit here, when you look at what is happening with the Trump administration, just in the first 10 days, it's hard not to, you know, come to the conclusion, or at least be fearful, that this is going to end in calamity, that we're headed towards something really bad. Dean also said that, you know, the statement that Trump put out last night, that Trump's people put out last night as regards the woman he had just fired, was, so that, as a former White House counsel, it's a statement the likes of which he had never seen come from a White House. He'd never seen this talk of betrayal, this politicized talk, just incredible language.
Well, speaking of
language, we ought to pause and think about this.
Speaking of language, this is what happened at the White House press briefing today. This is Kristen Welker from NBC versus Sean Spicer.
As I'm willing to go at this time, Kristen.
Sean, thanks. You're saying it's not a ban. This was President Trump's tweet yesterday. If the ban were announced with a one-week notice, the bad would rush into our country during that week. So he says it's a ban.
I mean, he's using the words that the media is using. But at the end of the day, it can't... Hold on. It can't be... Jonathan, thanks. I'll let Kristen talk. It can't be a ban if you're letting a million people in. If 325,000 people from another country can't come in, that is by nature not a ban.
I understand your point.
It is extreme.
The president himself called it a ban.
I understand.
Is he confused, or are you confused?
No, I'm not confused. I think that the words that are being used to describe it are derived from what the media is calling this. He's been very clear that it is extreme vetting.
Those are his words. All right, so there's Sean Spicer telling Kristen Welker that Donald Trump calling it a ban doesn't mean it's a ban, because he's just using the verbiage of the media. I have a question for you. Didn't he earlier this week, as well as Steve Bannon, say that the media was the enemy?
Well, they're the enemy.
Yeah.
They get everything wrong.
Yeah.
Right? You know, fake, whatever, everything he says. And also, I mean, remember, this use of the term ban, why would the media use that? Why do you think they would use that? Would it be because, going back to 2015, that's a word that Donald Trump has used with regard to banning Muslims, right, from entering the United States. He has used this term, not just recently. It wasn't like, I've never actually used this phrase before, but I'm hearing the media ban it out. So for shorthand, to help to speed the conversation along, I will employ the inappropriate term ban, right? No. This was a common phrase associated with him. Now,
to a policy that he has put forward without much thought. But that doesn't change the reality, and it's not, you know, you're not using the media's term here. This is actually a, you know, one of those difficult situations where you have an administration that is trying to spin a certain language. It's trying to spin a certain way of talking about something. And you have some media outlets, not even all of them, by the way, saying, well, no, that's not an accurate portrayal of that. This is what it is. And, you know, again, what I would argue is go back and look not merely at Trump's executive order, but at the interview he did the day.
Want to speak up just a little bit, John?
Sure. Go back and look not merely at Trump's executive order, but at the interview that he did on the day that order came out with the Christian Broadcasting Network.
Correct.
And when you see what he's saying there, it is certainly suggesting priorities, right? That some religious groupings will have priority over others. And so it's not inappropriate to say this. Now, if he wants to step up and say, people are referring to this as a Muslim ban, that's wrong, but I understand how they might misinterpret it because I gave an interview that might be misinterpreted. Let me clarify what our policy is.
Well, Donald Trump would never do that.
I know.
All right.
But if he did, he could, you know what I mean? Then what Sean Spicer's saying wouldn't sound absolutely absurd.
All right, finally, this is, I forget which committee this is, Chairman Orrin Hatch, none too happy. The Democrats are now boycotting some of the confirmation hearings for some of the appointees. This is very funny.
I'm really disappointed that my friends on the other side, our Democrats on the other side, are deliberately boycotting this markup. Why that's an important thing for them, I'll never understand, because these two nominees are going to go through regardless.
Even though I obviously have a cold, I want you to know that I am reporting for duty and ready to vote. I note with interest that all we see is empty chairs over there. I don't know, I can't remember a time that I've been on this committee where people just didn't show up.
We have just been presented, just a few minutes ago, with a list of demands by the Democrats. Didn't have the courtesy to tell us a week ago, and they could have easily done that, although that was too late too, because we've had these hearings, we've had all these meetings, we've worked together, and I was led to believe that they were ready to vote today.
This is really amazing that we are witnessing. I think this is a completely unprecedented level of obstruction.
and boy, if anybody knows how to measure unprecedented levels of obstruction, these guys are good at it. Right?
Exactly. All right, your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, the other day, Donald Trump.
Speak up just a little bit.
I'm sorry. The other day, Donald Trump accused Chuck Schumer of fake tears, right? Being overly dramatic. I think if you know Chuck Schumer's story, his family history, and the story of his political career.
His middle name is Ellis, after Ellis Island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that in fact, that was an appropriate criticism or appropriate line from Donald Trump. But if we're going to talk about politicians being theatrical, I would say the performance is there. Those are Academy Award level performances. I mean, admittedly, the acting's a little, you know, imperfect.
Well, Pat Roberts has a cold.
Yeah, I actually thought that added some drama to it, didn't you? You know, like they bring the stretchers in, like for the filibuster. I'm ailing, but I'm here.
He didn't catch the cold in Kansas because he doesn't go there.
Not going there for another few years. But The interplay between them where they're like sort of dramatically talking, and Orrin Hatch, you know, I assumed he was about to break down in tears any moment, just horrified by it.
Are you accusing them of feigned indignation?
I am totally accusing them of feigned indignation. People who practiced aggressive and unyielding obstruction, they actually made obstruction bureaucratic. They kind of ruined the good name of obstruction by making it boring because they did it so much. Right, it was constant, and they didn't even talk about it. They just kind of, I got to go down to the office and, you know, punch in. I'm going to do another day of obstruction. Would be so overly dramatic when, and understand what the Democrats are doing here, is they are seeking to slow down a rush to put aside the system of checks and balances, to put aside the concept of advice and counsel, advice and consent, core concepts of what the Senate's supposed to do, in order to rush through Donald Trump's picks. And there's a broad understanding that Donald Trump's nominees have a lot of problems, ethical scandals, political scandals. And in some cases, and obviously, Betsy DeVos, just real questions about basic competence, you know, basic ability to do the job. When you have all of this, and you say, well, I've never seen anything like this; it's unprecedented. No. The Democrats are saying we need to spend a little more time on some of this. And
do you think the Democrats are being buttressed by the people hitting the streets and the people calling their congressmen and senators? In other words,
without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I think that's almost I'm hearing people stepping up and saying, "Oh, the people are leading." Yeah, I definitely think that's true. But it's also this other phenomenon: the Democrats aren't very good at doing. Right. I mean, their track record is really lousy. And so now we have a clear disconnect, right, where, you know, the people are so passionate about resisting this government that they're going out at, you know, Saturday night and filling airports, Sunday afternoon filling the center of Boston, Sunday night filling the center of Seattle. I mean, people are really passionate. And you have, you know, all sorts of very serious commentators from across the country and around the world stepping up and saying, you know, this is a very serious matter. We need to draw lines in the sand. We need to say no. We need to resist. And then you have Democrats who are still like, I'm going to kind of sort it out. You know, I'm going to, I'll have to think about what I'm going to do here. That disconnect is problematic for those Democrats in Congress who have not quite wrapped their head around this thing. Now, in fairness to them, you know, I think they are being pulled by their constituents, being pulled by the great mass of people to step up. And I also think that while you can be critical of some of the Democrats for being, you know, soft, imperfect in responding to some of these things, I would finally just point to Patrick Leahy's dissent on Jeff Sessions today in the Judiciary Committee, which was, in my opinion, one of the most remarkable statements ever made in a hearing of this sort. I mean, he really did pull together the concerns about what happened at the Department of Justice the night before, Sessions' record, and a really deep understanding of the role of the Department of Justice, the role of the Attorney General. It was just a brilliant statement. So there are Democrats who are, in my opinion, doing a remarkable job and deserving very, very high marks. I even think Chuck Schumer's doing pretty good on a number of things. But they are not, at this point, as coherent in their opposition as seemingly the great mass of people are. And so I do think there's a push and pull there.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.